It is now my pleasure to introduce Mindy Gingery. She is a certified registered nurse anesthetist and owner of Heartland Anesthesia and Consulting in Des Moines, Iowa. She has an MSN from the University of Iowa and has been a CRNA since 2004. Her company provides anesthesia services across the state of Iowa and in critical access hospitals, ASCs, and offices. Please join me in welcoming Mindy.
All right, does this work? Wonderful. All right, well, I have decided that there is no way I can stand up at the podium and do death by PowerPoint. So, you know what? I'm a walker, I'm a talker. If you don't like jazz hands, don't look, because you know what? I'm a hand talker. So, just be aware. I want this to be very informal. I want it to be something that is helpful for you. That is why I am here. And please interrupt anytime, or shouldn't say interrupt, raise your hand anytime that you need to ask a question, because I want this to be something that is useful that you can take back to your ASC. So as she was saying, my name is Mindy Gingery. I've been a nurse for 29 years. I've been a CRNA for 20 years. And I worked for an anesthesia group for 2 years after I got done. And I decided, you know what? I don't like how I'm treated. I don't like how this is all going. I don't like how they have this set up. So you know what? I'm just going to do it myself. So 2 years after graduating, I actually went out on my own, started as just myself, and now how many years later? 18 years later, I suppose. Heartland Anesthesia and Consulting. We cover 32 facilities in the state of Iowa, including 17 hospitals, 5 ambulatory surgery centers, and then we are kind of the dental office king and queens of Iowa. We do a lot of deep sedation for dental procedures in dental as well as oral surgeons' offices. So that's just kind of a little bit about me, and I just wanted to talk about some of those things before we go over the disclaimer. I also want to say one more thing before we get started, and that is when I was asked to do this lecture, you know, I have, since I've been a nurse, I've been a CRNA for so long, oh my gosh, I've been in your seat so many times, sitting and watching lectures, and you're like, okay, yeah, I already know that. This is a waste of time. You know, is it time? Is it 5 o'clock yet? Can we go have a drink? And so I decided I want to bring a different spin to this. So what I am wanting to do is something a little bit different, and that is that I want to not only talk about the business of anesthesia contracts, but I also want to bring in the anesthesia part of it. I want to say, you know what, these are some of the things that are good for you, are good for anesthesia. These are the reasons why anesthesia may ask for something specific, because I thought, you know what, I have that ability to do that. I negotiate all my own contracts throughout my company, and so I want to be able to provide that to you. I think the last thing that I bring that is a little unique as well is that even though I own Heartland Anesthesia and Consulting, I love giving anesthesia. I am still in the OR. I'm not in the OR as much as I want anymore, but I am in the OR at least every week, 1 to 2 times a week. And so, you know, there's nothing worse than putting a contract together and the anesthesia providers are like, no, we're not going to do that. That's not okay with us. Where I bring that perspective, where in my company, my one motto is, I don't expect my providers to do anything I wouldn't do myself, and it gives me a chance to actually see that in action. So those are some of the things that I'm hoping that I can bring to this lecture today. All right, so of course, some of the disclaimers. I am not a contract lawyer. I am here pretty much because of the fact that I have just done this for a very long time in a lot of different settings. I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist. I want to make it very well known that I am not here to be biased towards any type of anesthesia model, and I truly think anything that I say here today should be applicable, whatever your team model may be. The information contained in my presentation has just been gathered by myself. I don't want anyone to think that it was smooth sailing. I'm going to say it again a little bit later. Your best friend is the addendum to the contract, because you know what? You realize, yeah, this is not working well. And so that's what I bring to the table. I also want to say that I am not naive or blinded to the fact that I live in the state of Iowa. I work only in the state of Iowa, and all of my facilities are there as well. So really, every state might be slightly different. You're going to have different rules, regs, state regulations, hospital regulations. The one thing that I am very well versed in, though, is conditions of participation, whether that be for hospitals or for ASC anesthesia services. So that would be the one thing that would be consistent. Contract language also may be dictated by your facility or your facility affiliate. I am also not naive to the fact that some ASCs are affiliated and some are affiliated with a larger center, and including bylaws and things like that. So I would want to bring that to light. And the majority of my presentation is based on anesthesia contracted groups, but you know what? I have also done the other way as a provider myself, so you know what? Certainly feel free to talk about hospitals as well. So some of the objectives, I'm not going to go over these. You saw all of these. As you can see, I changed the name of my presentation. I didn't even know they named my presentation. Because I was, of course, always 5 minutes late. I'm always the 5 minute late kind of gal. I was so proud. I was here 20 minutes early this morning. And so I had to text my husband and let him know that, because that's not usual for me. So you can see those. So we're going to do contracts. Everyone hates this. And you know what? You would be fibbing if you said, wow, you know what? I just want to go and have an adversarial conversation with someone who wants me to peel their grapes and, you know, and feed them to me personally. I get it. And then for those of you who are my age, you remember when you were a kid, and if no one wanted to do something, you would sit in a circle and you would go one, two, three. Not it. Definitely anesthesia, not it. That is not what I'm going to pick for myself today. I get it, and I'm here to say I resign myself to that fact. I do understand that. So what kind of contract language do you need to have? Well, it really depends on your facility. And you want to say to yourself, Mindy, okay, yeah, well, that's a real helpful piece of information. Oh, it depends. Isn't that the worst when people say, oh, well, it depends? Well, for heaven's sakes, let's be a little more specific than that. But it truly does depend. You know what? It depends on your facility. Is it actually independent? Is it highly affiliated with a hospital? What type of staffing numbers do you need? Do you do surgery every day? Do you just do it something that's a few days a week? Are you looking for permanent, temporary, intermittent help? What is it that you're looking for when it comes to anesthesia? And then, of course, staffing in general. Are you looking for a whole group, or is it something that you are willing to do it with one or two providers if that's acceptable to your facility, and you're doing maybe not so much of a group, but finding two people to come together? Talking about your payment model, and my one mantra, if you go away with anything, first of all, addendums are king. You always have to know that you have the opportunity to do an addendum, but putting in expectations into your contract. So, what I call my two types of contracts are short version and long version. So if you're looking for someone who's more temporary, someone who it's just a very small group, you know what? You can get away with what I call a short version contract. And at the end, I have my contact information. If anybody wants to reach out to me, I'm happy to share any of my anesthesia contracts. They are ones that I have put together myself, and I've had vetted through many facilities, but I have a short and I have a long. So the short is going to be literally just the facts, ma'am. It is going to be the term, the payment, what happens if you cancel, termination criteria, indemnification. This is another one of my soapboxes I'll talk about later. Any contract that you do should always be mutually indemnified. Don't allow an anesthesia group to come in and say, well, you have to indemnify me, but I'm not going to indemnify you. Well, no. Everybody has to have a dog in the fight. Expectations, licensing certifications that you are with third-party payers, and of course, assignment and billing. And that is usually about a 4 to 5 page contract is what you're looking at there. Or you have the long version. You know what? I need a whole team of anesthesia providers. We need permanent coverage. And that is going to be your 10-plus type contract. There's going to be a lot more legal ease in it, just because of the fact that there are the people who are going to be there, hopefully from now until evermore, providing your anesthesia services. So what should be addressed? I apologize. I started some new medication, and oh my, they didn't tell me the dry mouth it was going to give me. So what should be addressed? Coverage needs. I always like to say that I like this to be specifically vague, if that makes any sense. Don't put yourself into a pigeonhole. If you want to do something where you are outlining very specific days of the week, those type of things, put those in an exhibit. You know what? Then you can, and don't put them in the body of the contract. Put them in an exhibit, exhibit A, exhibit B. So then that way, if you essentially have an addendum that say, you know, we're changing this particular exhibit, you can do that and you don't have to worry about anything being in the body of the contract. Your anesthesia situation, of course, are they employed? Are they contracted? How are payment for services going to look? Is it going to be something where you are actually negotiating what is it that you're going to be paid? How is that going to look? Or is it that the anesthesia group is going to be doing the billing? Those are something, either way, is very acceptable. This next one is the stickiest wicket that you come into when it comes to anesthesia contracts. And I suggest being as specific as possible, and we'll go over this in a little bit, and that is cancellations. And when I say cancellations, I don't mean cancellations like a case cancels. I mean a whole provider needs to be canceled. You know what? Maybe we run with 5 providers, but you know what? Next Wednesday, we need 4. What's that look like? Because you know what? You're going to have a really angry anesthesia group if something is not mutually acceptable to both, because of the fact that they may have to pay that individual anyway if they're not your employees of your ASC. Expectations, we're going to spend some time on what expectations are of anesthesia providers, and then, of course, any legal aspects that you may have. So coverage needs, what are you looking for? Do you need something consistent? Is it variable? That needs to be in the contract. Anything that is in italics is something that you need to have a conversation and a full agreement understanding with the anesthesia group, but it's something you can talk about and doesn't have to be in the contract. And the biggest one is, you know what, float. Is there going to be a float person? Is there going to be somebody that's doing the pre-ops, going to be doing the blocks if that happens in your ASC? Or someone who can, you know, oversee the PACU, do any type of post-op that you need them to do? Is that something I personally feel in all of my ASCs that is the most efficient model? But once again, if you have a really super small ASC, then you know what? That would not be financially feasible. I personally include in my contracts something very specific, like an OR day is 07 to 15. The reason I do that is trial and error. There has been times in the past where, as the old lady of the group, I was the workhorse, and I was the one that stayed late, and I was the one who had not outlined that. So all of a sudden, at 6 o'clock at night, everybody else left, and I'm still there doing that. So I don't do this to be punitive, but it's something that everybody needs to be aware of. I charge overtime afterwards. I bill 3 out of the 5 of my ASCs directly to insurance, but even in those situations, there is still an overtime rate. And I do that so that everybody has a dog in the fight. And I think that's important. Is there going to be a call person? Do you have call? Is there going to be a late person? And of course, anesthesia status. Employed is everyone's dream, honestly. You know what? It's the same people. They're there all the time. It is very stable, but it is very expensive, especially if you have a variable OR schedule. If you need 3 one day, 1 the next day, you're paying 2 people to sit at home, and that can be very expensive. Contracted can be very stable, but you need to outline the expectations as well as the time frames in your contract. So payment of services, employed versus contracted, of course, that's going to be you know, something that you're going to have a whole financial side. So we're going to talk a little bit later about some Stark Law and some anti-kickback stuff. And everything you're going to see, fair market value, fair market value. I hear that all the time. And I think that people think I'm lying when I'm like, there is no website that is that. There is nothing. There is no book you can go to. There's no one person you can go to. Fair market value is your state, your region in your state, your anesthesia model, what type of cases you're doing even. Is it going to be a special anesthesia skill that's going to have to be done that maybe not everyone has? All of these things are going to be a part of the provider mix. You're going to see MGMA data. You're going to see data come out of the Anesthesia National Associations. I'm just going to tell you, here's the problem with them. They are a lot of times behind current market. Second of all, you're going to get the people for salaries or expected payment right in the middle. Nobody who is in a smaller facility or a solo provider or whatever, they're making more money because you know what? They have more responsibility and more time put into their services. They're going to get paid more. They don't want anybody to know that. So they're not going to answer that on a survey. So you just don't get the best participations. Generally, MGMA data, just for your own knowledge, really is more for larger hospital type settings, especially anesthesia care team models. You're going to see that a lot and definitely are not reflective of a CRNA only model. Who does the billing? So that's something else you're going to have to address. Does the ASC, do you do it independently yourself within your facility? Do you actually send it to the hospital? Do you have an alliance with them? And if it's an anesthesia group, and I know that there is a lot more under this anesthesia group, and this is because I do a lot of insurance billing, is there a guarantee or a stipend? This is something that I tell ASCs and I tell hospitals all the time. I've done this for 18 years. All the way up until the last 3 years, I sat on this side of the table and you sat on this side of the table. And for the last 3 years, we both are sitting on the same side of the table. And that is because the rates for anesthesia expected reimbursement for services has skyrocketed. Some of that is supply and demand. Some of that is, you know what, just like every industry, we're being hit the exact same. But because of the fact that you want to get services and I need to be able to pay providers what they expect or they're going to go to another group and then I don't have providers for your facility. That's why for the first time ever, we are really on the same side. Before, the market was much more manageable. Now, it's incredibly high. In the state of Iowa, anesthesia services have increased 25% as far as what it is expected. I have one little area of the state of Iowa, 40% is what is expected increase. I blame social media, but I'll get off that soapbox. Social media, that's the problem. But if you do have a guarantee, because you need to make for certain that you're able to pay your providers, a lot of anesthesia groups are going to want a guarantee or a stipend. But you need to outline, what does that look like? Is it going to be on a daily basis, monthly basis, quarterly basis? That makes a huge difference in what your expenditure on anesthesia services is going to be. Huge. That's the number one thing. The time to determine when the guarantee is going to be in effect. A lot of times a guarantee is based on, okay, I'm going to collect this much money, and then what my guarantee is based on what I collect, then you know what, whatever that gap is, then you're making up that gap. You're making them whole. Well, what does that look like? It's not fair to do right away because you know what, you haven't gotten any insurance collections yet. I personally go right in the middle and I do 90. But the next thing that you're going to want to do, if that is in your contract, is you are going to want to have a phrase in there that says, what if it's 90, you send it to me at 90 days, and at 110 days, you get 5 collections that come back. What is that going to look like? You're going to want a sentence in your contract that says that amount has to be provided in a spreadsheet, and it has to be credited to the next guarantee. That'll save you a lot of money. You need to make for certain you do that. And fine print, are any of the billing fees associated with insurance billing for your anesthesia group, are any of those also being tacked on? 6 to 7% is what a billing company is going to take for collections. So is that part of it? How about credentialing fees for the providers at $50 per provider per month? That's what a lot of billing companies charge. Is that going to be tacked on to your guarantee? Make sure you know that. How is it going to be collected securely for the information for the group to be able to bill? And how are you going to handle self-pay payments, patients? The first time this happened to me, did not think about that. And they called me, still in my jammies, and they're like, well, we have a self-pay patient here. And I'm like, So make for certain that you have talked about that because that can be very problematic. Invoicing. Whether you are doing the billing or whether anesthesia is doing the billing, it needs to be something that is mutually good or mutually bad, whatever you want to say. If they don't send you the invoices in time, there needs to be a penalty for that. You need to say for every so many days that you are late, you know what, I'm going to charge you 1.5%. Same way on the anesthesia side. You know what, I'm going to charge 1.5% for every month that you don't pay. It needs to be mutually good for everyone. And then, of course, there always needs to be something in there about completion of records in a timely manner. I would also throw on there, if you're going to do your own credentialing and it's not something that's being done by the anesthesia group, there needs to be something in there about that. Anesthesia, they are the worst, worst. I mean, we have a credentialing person who happens to be my daughter. She's a nurse, and oh my gosh, there are times when she texts me and say, I have texted this person 10 times. They will not respond to me. Mom, I got to bring in the guns. You got to text them. And I do it, and but they're just terrible. Terrible. So have that in there as well. Cancellations. When you have to decrease a number of providers, something to definitely think about, and I would have it in writing. When does this need to occur? Some of that is going to depend on if your anesthesia group uses any contractors at all, they're going to have a contractual cancellation out. How many days is that? Is it 3 days? Is it 5? Is it 7 days? Whatever it may happen to be, you need to make for certain everything aligns. That's what the anesthesia group is going to say. What happens, and this is another sticky one, what happens if you reduce them and Surgeon X wants to add a case? And then you're like, you know what? We let our provider go. And that doesn't even matter if it's a contracted group or you're employed. Maybe you didn't need that number of anesthesia providers, and you said, sure, you can make your doctor's appointments on that day. All of a sudden, you're stuck with one less as well. What are the time frames for all of those? For ASCs, I do a smaller time frame than I do for hospitals, and that's because you do get a lot of add-ons. It is a situation where you do that. I do 72-hour business day hours, so 3 business days. You know, what they tried to pull one of my facilities until I put it an addendum, wanted to say, well, I told you on Friday afternoon. Well, no, and there's nothing I can do really over the weekend. So you know what? 3 business days. What happens if there's a surge in illness and you have to cancel an entire room? What happens if your sterilizer goes down? What happens if it's an act of nature? Whatever may happen to be, make for certain you have those addressed. And then, of course, just time frame for cancellations in general. I use the same number. Some people, if you're canceling everybody for whatever reason, they will go with a little higher number. I do 3 days regardless, personally. Additions. What are the obligations of the anesthesia group if you want an add a room, add a day equals add a provider? Is there a limit on the number of cases per day? Is there, and what I mean by that is I have one ASC that is very naughty, and they've even had to tell the surgeons, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, Mindy's going to come. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, I don't want that. And I have a very good relationship with them. But you know what? I have put that in place where, you know what, if it needs to go to the top, they know that there's a real problem and that they really need to look at this. And I have a very good relationship with them. But I actually have in my contract for one of the ASCs that is all orthopedics, and that is the number of cases and what qualifies one provider and what qualifies two. So, for instance, 6 cases in, we run only 2 rooms, it's a small ASC. 6 cases in each room is fine for one provider because they're all bigger cases, they're all totals and things like that. But if that room has more than 4 blocks in it, then we need an additional provider. And that is just due to this particular ASC. They want things to be very efficient. They want the overtime, you know, the turnover to be, you know, well, in their mind, you know, 5 seconds, but, you know, I mean, a short amount of time. Well, you know what? They don't want to float. So guess what? If you don't have a float, then we have to put these parameters on there or we can't possibly get it done. And then we're always the bad guys. So don't be surprised if you see something like that. Is there an overtime rate? If within a certain time you want to add, if you're not within that time, like you call them the night before, is it based on availability? Is it guaranteed that they have to cover you? That is something that you are going to want to decide for your own facility and have that in your actual contract. And then the obligations, same coin, different side. You know what? When do you need to let them know what staffing numbers you need? And then kind of just to talk about, when do you need to notify them of add-ons? Things such as that, like add-ons to the day of a case. Payment options, these are all the ones that I have seen really over the course of my career. It can be a flat annual fee. That is generally hospital. It's generally critical access hospital that has call. Those are the ones you're going to see a lot of flat fees. The hospital could not possibly pay enough when you have 24/7 coverage, so you just do it as an annual stipend. A daily fee with overtime, a monthly fee, a per RVU fee. I don't know what that's done a ton in the ASC market, but we do that for some smaller hospitals, or the anesthesia group bills insurance directly. These are the ones that that we do primarily when we're going to talk in just a little bit about some Stark law and anti-kickback violations. The one thing you always need to keep in mind is be very wary if the contract says that the way anesthesia is paid is on percentage of profit from the facility. If you have anesthesiologists in your group, that is a Stark law violation. Be very careful of that. Is there going to be an increase? Is there going to be an annual increase? Is it going to be, I put in mind personally, if there is a change in workload or services that need to be provided, I always put in there, we reserve the right at any time, if that occurs, to come back and renegotiate. I've had some hellacious situations occur where literally the workload and the number of hours almost doubled. And once again, had to add an addendum to that because I realized that after the fact. Is it going to be a consumer price index, so essentially inflation, 2.8 to 3.2% every year? Or you're probably going to start to see a lot of contract plus or contract plus cost. Wow. Contract plus cost. Those are the ones that you're going to see. Now, expectations. This is a big thing. And I don't care if you're CRNAs. I don't care if you're anesthesiologists. I don't care if you're a mixture of both. These should be expectations that you have. The numbers that are needed, are they employed? You're going to want to have something, regardless of whether they're employed or contracted, can they work elsewhere? If they're contracted, it's almost inherently just said, yeah, they can go otherwise. But you know what? I always haven't put that in there just in case. Can you work outside of that? I put in every single contract I have, it doesn't matter what the facility type, even though it is an exclusive contract, everybody has to be a partner. That your anesthesia group should not be the ghosts that walk in and out and you see the back of their head as they walk down the hall. They need to be your partner in your ASC. And because of that, what happens if Heartland Anesthesia literally cannot staff you? It is unfair of me to say, well, sorry, it's exclusive, don't know what you're gonna do. You know what, I always put a statement in there that says, if for some reason I cannot provide it, you need to be allowed for someone else to be able to provide that. I always put that, and any group who shies away from that, you need to be wary of, because you shouldn't expect it would happen in your group, but it does. And if a group, y'all talked about that, standardization, you know, if that's something that you have, you need X amount of providers, and pre-op responsibilities. I provide every facility, and I think every anesthesia group should, with a comprehensive hold medication list. It's like 5 pages long. It is every med I can possibly think of that needs to be held. I'm happy to share that with any of you as well. I also go through and redo my evidence-based preoperative testing guidelines every single year. Is this still evidence-based? Is this still what needs to happen? If so-and-so and such-and-such has X, Y, and Z, you know what? They need to have electrolytes, they need to have an EKG. That would be something that you would want to ask your anesthesia providers for. And I have something also that is called a no fly list, or an anesthesia deeper dive list, essentially. These people here, don't even schedule them. They are inappropriate, based on the literature, inappropriate for an ASC facility. Second ones are ones that have substantial health issues, but yet, you know what? Let's look. Let's see how functional they are. That's something that I also think is important. And communication. I have a line in every contract, and you should have in yours, that, you know what, anesthesia is available for consult whenever is needed by your ASC. And then you can kind of talk about who it is that person might happen to be. They're going to participate. Oh, this is always a good one when they give you the blank stare of, what? We have to do QA, QI, and PI? What? Can't someone else do that? No, you need to participate in that. Also participating in policy review, accreditation inspections, that's something else you can put in for your expectations. I have cut off more accrediting body, whoever they may happen to be, them going down a rabbit hole if you can have an anesthesia provider there. And they're like, no, that's not how we do that. And then it's immediately cut off. That is very, very important. How about if they need new equipment? Budget limits, budget items, what's the process for that? Malpractice insurance limits. I would suggest, and this all depends on your state, so please look at your state. In the state of Iowa, there is really no regulations on who has to have what. If you don't have specific regulations, make for certain anesthesia and the surgeons are the same. You do not want to have an anesthesia provider who's 1 million, 3 million, and your surgeon is 2 million, 6 million. Guess who they're going to go after, and that's going to be someone within your facility. Make for certain, in fact, I even have in my contracts that I reserve the right to see the face sheets of the surgeons to make for certain that I'm not the deep pocket. But for your sakes, don't be the deep pocket either. Immunizations, vaccinations, who pays for these? Once again, this is never heard of this before until I had one particular facility that in the end, beyond normal, what I would call normal vaccinations, the ones that I've listed there, almost $1,000 per provider of extra stuff that the ASC wanted them to have. And I didn't have anything about who pays for that. So you know what, is that in your contract? Make for certain that you realize that. Who is it that's going to pay for it? Because you know what? If it's in there, you may end up paying for it as well. So make for certain that you have looked at that. And then this is something that I think, and I'm just going to be honest, I have this in my contracts probably because of the fact that I am a CRNA-only group. You know, let's just face facts. I mean, it is what it is. But I have in every contract that anesthesia reserves the right of refusal for any patient that is essentially outside of anesthesia's standard of care, standard of practice, for an ASC. I don't know what I'm doing. For heaven's sakes, I'm so sorry. For an ASC, and I think that is really important. But I have also been at... that it was a care team, and the same exact, they had the same exact thing in there, because you know what, they had a couple of surgeons that, I guess, liked to debate and liked to argue, and so anesthesia had to put that in there, because you know what, no. And what I always tell surgeons, personally, is I always say, you know what, I have never canceled a case in my whole life. In my entire career, I've never canceled a case. I have definitely canceled anesthetics. So if you feel that for your lab coli, for this inappropriate patient, if you feel they would tolerate it okay without anesthesia, please feel free to go ahead. And of course, then they just kind of look at me and then they just walk away. So Just make for certain that, you have done that. And provider qualifications, I'm sure you have a list. Make certain that you do. That, you know what, whatever it may happen to be in your state, do they have prescriptive authority, that they have an active DEA, that they have an unrestricted license, all of those things. If they lose their license, if they lose their ability to be able to be reimbursed by any insurance company, you know what, have that in there, that they are automatically out. And I think that's very appropriate, especially if you're billing for your center. And credentialing, who pays for it? And what needs to be provided by your anesthesia group? There is invariably someone in every single group that holds the magic folder with everybody's credentialing stuff in there. And don't you know, be reaching out to anesthesia providers all the time. You know what? Find out who that person is, and they can provide all of them to you. For my particular company, we actually have it all electronically. Any facility can have a portal to our software, which is also our staffing software. They can get in there and actually download current ACLS, current this, current that, current the other thing. And that is something that I think has been very helpful. So if they have something like that, utilize it. Don't take that upon yourself. Legal aspects. Once again, this is a good. This is a win-win. And I say this from both standpoints. This has happened to me a couple of times. Either I had a provider, so it's a little bit different situation, but a provider who didn't give me 90 days notice. Or I had a facility who ended up just getting their own provider and didn't give me 90 days notice. But guess what? All it said was, you have to give a 90 days notice. So what happens if you don't? What happens if you don't do that? So I would suggest that you have in your contracts that if whatever the termination time period is, if that is not given, that there is a financial disincentive for that to occur. A lot of times, it's a liquidated damages clause that essentially says, if they walk out of here tomorrow, based on the number of cases that we did last quarter or whatever it may happen to be, this is what the liquidated damages are going to be from the time they gave notice all the way up until the terms of the contract. And that is perfectly acceptable. Absolutely acceptable. I would sign that in a heartbeat because I know I will never give less than 90 days notice, unless it's a for cause notice, of course, unless it's a little bit different. For cause, make for certain that you have 30 days to be able to cure that breach, just in case it's something that can actually be rectified. Contract length, initial length, is it a different ongoing period? I like to do initially 1 year. That freaks people out. And they say, well, do you plan on leaving after a year? Well, no, but you know what? I need to make for certain that we like you, and I need to make for certain that you like us. So you know what? Let's do a year, make for certain it's gonna go okay, then we can go for longer. I don't do that because I'm trying to slide out of something. I do it because you know what? What if it's just not working? Why have to give a 90-day, you know, I mean, I just feel like that's the good thing to do as a partner. Automatic renewals, what time periods, renegotiation. Once again, the only one that I always do a little bit of when it comes down to is I've had some contracts that have been provided to me that said, you can only terminate this contract within a certain number of days of the term period. So essentially that means you can't just give 90 days. You can only give 90 days on October 1st for a January 1st term period. Not a good thing. I wouldn't do that with you, with any anesthesia provider or group, and I won't do that as the group myself. So, and of course, holding both parties harmless. You should have something in there. It talks about cooperating during a transition. You know what? Just because of the fact that you're parting ways does not mean that they need to burn the house down. They need to make for certain that they're going to cooperate with you. Oh, and then non-competes. There's just nothing better than a nice non-compete. Of course, the FTC, as you all know, they are looking into this heavily. I think it will go all the way to the Supreme Court level. I really, truly do. So it's going to be very state dependent. In the state of Iowa, non-competes are very difficult from an anesthesia standpoint to uphold. But guess what people don't remember? You still have to pay $150,000 to your lawyer to fight that. So yeah, you might get out of it, but you know what? It's not free. It's not free at all. So, but in the state of Iowa, one thing I did like is they just passed, and it was signed January 1st, that staffing agencies for providers, whether it be nurses or ARMP, CRNAs, they cannot have non-competes, like national staffing agencies. So that was a huge win. Non-solicitations, you need to have that. The last thing that you want is for your anesthesia group to leave, and all of a sudden they go to another one and they take half your staff with them. You don't want that to happen. Everyone needs to be held to a non-solicitation. If you need to further dissect that down and what does a non-solicitation mean, go ahead and do it. I have one facility that I literally must have five different things that qualify as a non-solicitation. But it's because they're naughty and I have to do that. It's that same facility. They're something else. Governing laws in your state. If you have a anesthesia group who comes from another state, then you know what? Make for certain it's your state. That's important. And of course, adding changes as an addendum. Addendums are king, and less time with your legal department. All right, so what do we got? Oh, I've got 20 minutes left. Okay, so we're going to talk about Stark Law and anti-kickback. So if you have some coffee, you're going to need it because it's boring. It's very boring. But you know what? I think it is something that you need to think about. Okay, so Stark Law and anti-kickback. So this is specifically Stark Law. I'm not going to go through all of this. Now, you guys have access to my slides, right? Okay, good. So I'm not going to go through all of this. This is right from actual regulations. But all you need to remember is that Stark Law is for physicians. It is for physicians, and it has to do with self-referral. Self-referral can mean a whole lot of different things, but it is about self-referral. It is a civil penalty. So the thing about a civil penalty is that because it's civil and it's not criminal, that means that you could inadvertently be doing it, and ignorance is not a defense. So if you do having a Stark Law violation, but when you really think about it, honestly, when we start talking about some of the examples of Stark Law violations, it's dirty pool. I mean, it is completely, it's nothing. I mean, it's things that you would say, yeah, that does not sound right at all. So one good thing about Stark Law is I think it's fairly understandable. So it prohibits physicians from making certain designated health services payable by Medicare to an entity, essentially where they have a financial relationship. I do think that there are some elements of Stark Law that go a little too far, but I think some of them are really to protect a lot of people. But like, for instance, there was one example that I thought was inappropriate when I was looking, and it was if you were a physician and you and your wife owned a radiology group and someone needed some sort of radiologic intervention, that if your group or you refer to them, that could be considered a Stark Law violation. I think that happens all the time, and it has nothing to do with trying to do anything bad. It has to do with the fact that, well, if they have to go somewhere, well, why not? And I don't know if you're even really thinking about the financial side of it. You just trust your wife's group, you know? So there are a few that can get a little bit dicey there. If a Stark Law is violated, once again, it's civil. So whether it's intentional or unintentional, $15,000 for each service provided. So for every referral that you do that was inappropriate, $15,000 a piece. Up to 5 years in jail, and then of course they can add some other civil penalties up to $100,000. Fair market value and per click arrangements. I have to admit, I didn't even know what that was. I had to look it up. I'm like, what is a per click? What a per click is, when I was looking it up, is generally has to do with equipment. So it has to do with equipment that is owned by a physician who is probably one of your ASC owners as well. All right? So what happens is it is a violation as a per click because that physician is not only getting the profits from the facility, they're also getting the profits off of the piece of large piece of equipment that they are renting back to the ASC. So that is a Stark Law violation. So I'll give you an example. I had a critical access hospital about an hour and a half from Des Moines, kind of center of the state. Had a urologist. The urologist owned a lithotripsy machine, and he was from Des Moines. But that lithotripsy machine stayed in a critical access hospital an hour and a half from Des Moines. All of his Des Moines patients, he would send an hour and a half to go have a lithotripsy because he made money on doing the case and on the lithotripsy. We are no longer providing services. There was a lot of funny business going on there, but every time I would stand at the head of the table, I would think, this is not right. This has got to be violating some law. And sure enough, of course, it's a Stark Law. It does apply to ambulatory surgery centers that are owned by hospitals, doctor's offices, specialty cosmetic centers. And essentially, it is something that is very well in line with Stark as well as anti-kickback. When it comes to an ASC, I mean, really most hospitals as well, your chances of an anti-kickback are much more than a Stark Law violation. So it's probably going to be an anti-kickback. But some of the common red flags for a Stark Law violation in ASC, buying or selling shares that are under market value or at a very steep discount, buying out doctors who don't use the center. And you're like, well, what does that matter? Well, it has to do with referral base, because if you have a physician who is making money off the profits of that particular ASC, but they're not bringing any cases, they're not referring anyone, you're buying them out. In essence, you're trying to bring someone else in who will self-refer to your facility. That's why it's a Stark Law violation. Leasing equipment below market value. Per clicks, we kind of talked about that. Oh, look at that, lithotripter's right on there. Yeah, that's one of them. But it's a major piece of equipment. So you need to be very careful that if you are doing that, that you're paying a very good market rate for that. And of course, anything that's a sham, essentially, they're paying someone to not really be who they are. Anti-kickbacks. Not going to go through all of this, but what this has to do with is anti-kickbacks is that the take-home message is that if you're getting something for free or highly, highly discounted, you need to be thinking, is there an anti-kickback coming here? And the thing about anti-kickback that's different is, unlike Stark, that's physician only, anti-kickback is everybody. Anybody can be pulled into this. And if you violate an anti-kickback, both parties are liable because they feel you both should have known better. This is exchange of money or other things of value for the purpose of influencing business. So it can even be something like if you have GE comes to your facility and says, you know what, if you're going to buy all new anesthesia machines, if you buy three of them, I'm going to give you one for free. That's fine, because you're paying for the three. But if they come and they say, you know what, we offer this and a whole lot more, I'm going to give you an anesthesia machine for free. That's a violation of an anti-kickback, because what they're looking for is for you to use them not only for other anesthesia machines, but for other supplies and all of that they may have as well. That is considered an anti-kickback. A couple of different types of anti-kickback there. It's really all very, very similar. But the anti-kickback does apply to both parties. So what's the difference? All right, red is Stark and blue is anti-kickback. So Stark Law, once again, it's physicians for self-referring. Anti-kickback is anybody who might be in that. Stark Law, physicians only, and I feel like referral is something that in the healthcare world, we think of a referral as something different than what everyone else thinks of as a referral. Referral can be for anything. Services, medications, anything can be that. It's not just actual referral from one provider to the next. This is a comparison. You should be able to see this on your slides. We have gone over all of this. It's just really talking about anti-kickback is criminal. So that is a criminal type of violation, but you do have to justify that it was done with malice. Unlike Stark, Stark is, doesn't matter if you were just being foolish, you're liable, and that is a civil penalty, where anti-kickback is a criminal penalty. I'll tell you a super quick example of one of these that happened in Georgia. In Georgia, there was an anesthesia group, and they staffed a very large GI center. Some of you may have GI centers. I don't know why they did this, and I don't even really think that they were doing something bad, but you know what? It looked pretty bad. They were providing the entire center with propofol. Well, they were providing it at a discounted rate, and it just was not properly documented. So it was looked at that anesthesia group was giving something highly discounted in order to be able to influence that ASC continuing to use them as an anesthesia group. I want to say it was close to $6 million is what they had to pay back. Because, of course, GI, you know what you're doing, how many, 40 of them a day, that's a lot. At, you know, $10,000 a pop. So that's some of the the differences. One other example that I did want to talk about super quick is when it comes to anesthesia. We're going to go over some anesthesia ones, but one thing that did come to my mind that is stark and not anti-kickback is if you have a facility where you have like a pain physician who is coming and doing pain procedures, and you need to make for certain that you watch that referral pattern, because if there is a situation where there is like a lower market value or something like that, that they're paying for those, with the understanding that all of the orthopedic surgeons are going to refer, that are then going to come and have their procedure done there, that's a Stark Law violation, because it has to do with physicians and it has to do with referrals. All right, so key points to remember. We kind of really went over a lot of that. I'm just going to go, anti-kickback is criminal, Stark Law is civil, Stark Law does not require proof, and anti-kickback does. So, bottom line is, if you're getting anything for free, or something that you think is really, really cheap, because wow, that's really cheap, you need to start thinking about anti-kickback at that particular time. So what are some of them that you might see? A professional courtesy case, when you're giving free anesthesia to a family member or someone who works there. Does that not happen? Of course. It happens all the time. We all know it is. It's actually an anti-kickback violation. Services done for free, even marketing. It doesn't have to be healthcare stuff. It could be marketing. Hey, we'll do your marketing for free, but you have to use us and we have to do this and that. That is an anti-kickback. Receiving equipment, medications for free, and paying below market rate for really anything. There are some safe harbors that are put in place. I would suggest that you actually go to the officer of the inspector general and look up some of these safe harbors. And really, they're intended to reduce some liability, and in my opinion, reduce liability on things that do occur all the time, but are not necessarily egregious in nature. Safe harbors really apply mostly to anti-kickback statutes, but they can have some places in Stark Law, but anti-kickback is the main one. But I don't want to go over all of that today, what a safe harbor is. The Inspector General is the one that really has the most comprehensive. Definitely look that up. So what are some of the safe harbors for anesthesia? So what a safe harbor is, once again, is the way that you put things out in words that are going to protect you from making for certain that you're not doing anything that is Stark Law or that is anti-kickback. Well, the agreement is in writing and signed by both parties. You would think That's the dumbest thing you have said this whole time. That happens all the time. Even major hospitals that have an outsourced group that don't actually have a contract. It's striking. So make for certain everything is signed. That the agreement covers all services and is very specific about those services. And if the agreement is intended to provide for the services that is periodic, that is part-time, that it says that. All right, it needs to say that. That it's something that's not every single day. That is one of your safe harbors. That the term of the agreement is not less than 1 year. That's a red flag. But there's also going to be exceptions for that. What if you're waiting for a group to come in and they can't start for 90 days and you have to bring people in? Well, for heaven's sakes. I mean, I think feel like that's self-explanatory. But you do need to think about that. And then, of course, your compensation, you need to make for certain it's fair market value or as close as you can get to fair market value, because it's really not very well known.
Yeah.
And just really making for certain, like I said before, that this is not something that's based on volume. If it's based on volume, it's based on percentage of profits, that's a big problem. Services that are performed under the agreement do not involve counseling or promotion of business arrangements or other activities that violate state law. Well, yeah, I would hope. And that the services do not exceed those that are reasonably necessary to accomplish the commercially reasonable business purpose of the service. I do want to apologize. I just noticed that these three, I did not cite those. If anybody is in, I do have the site. I just forgot to put the site on there. I cut and pasted these right from it because I didn't want to get them wrong. If anybody needs that for themselves, please reach out to me. I'll get you that article. Okay. All right. Whew. What time is it? Oh, 3 minutes to spare. All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I hope that there's been at least a pearl or two that you might be able to take away from this on whether what you should do, what anesthesia might be bringing to you, why they're bringing it to you. And I just really thank you for your time. I appreciate it so much. Oh, yeah. Thank you. And here's my three takeaways. You got to have those expectations in there. You absolutely have to have expectations for anesthesia, and they should be expected to follow them. Review your state laws, your hospital regs, all of those type of things. Please do that, because every state is going to be slightly different. And once again, if something seems too good to be true because they're giving it to me for free or highly discounted, be very, very wary of that, because that certainly can be a problem for you and a problem for them. So, any questions? Yes, ma'am.
You talked about liquidated.
Here, hold on. I have
it. We're seeing in our contracts.
Yeah, sorry.
Talking about liquidated damages. And we're seeing in some of our contracts, the ASCs are stating, when they have random days that they're wanting people, it's not set, it's random. And let's say we're not able to staff. The anesthesia group is not able to staff. I've seen now one health system now trying to put liquidated damages on that day that we were not able to staff because they were missing cases. Are you seeing that? We, of course, fought that. But I'm just wondering if that's something.
I have not, and that's nothing I would ever sign. And I wouldn't have
good. And the reason... And the reason that I wouldn't is because now, if you have a contract that says, like you said, this is something that's more PRN or more random, if it is random, that is not the responsibility of the anesthesia group to do that.
Yeah.
Now, happy to do that as long as you give me enough heads up. I'll turn the world upside down to make for certain that I have somebody in the seat to do that. But I would never sign anything like that. I wouldn't sign it at all. But at least I might think about it if it was like every day. You know, I mean, if it was a consistent thing. But no, that I feel like that's totally inappropriate because of the fact that that's essentially like telling an anesthesia group, you know what, it's so random. Well you're going to get paid based on the number of yellow VW bugs that go past this intersection. You know, it's something that is totally random. It's nothing that they can plan for. And let's face it, anesthesia providers are expensive. There is just no way around it. They're very expensive, and it's not somebody who you can just have five people sitting on the corner waiting to see if someone's going to do a last-minute addition. So I have not seen that at all. Okay. And I would not, I would fight that tooth and nail.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Can you speak to the pros and cons of engaging with anesthesia leadership or group in equity at a facility that's a freestanding ASC?
Okay, and what was the first part? I'm sorry.
Just if you can speak to the anesthesia lead or group as being included in equity and maybe the pros and cons to that and how easy it might be to unwind that.
Equity as in they're part owners or, okay, if they're part owners. How do you unwind that? Well, I've never experienced that myself as being an owner like that. But so you're looking to get out of that.
No. I'm just saying, you know, we're in a situation where we'd like to have them engaged as owners under fair market value.
Gotcha.
But
okay.
Then down the road, if something happens, like what happens?
Right. Well, you know what? I mean, if you want to engage them in that, as long as they are not doing anything that would be, you know, as physicians, that would be considered a Stark Law violation, there shouldn't be any reason why you couldn't do that. I don't work with them, but they're friends of mine who are anesthesiologists who are absolutely owners in ASCs in the Des Moines area. But just making for certain, once again, that they are not paid... except as an owner, if they're not paid for anesthesia services based on a percentage of the profits, they can absolutely have profits as an owner. That's completely different, but they cannot have their payment to do their services as a percentage. But I see that very routinely. As a matter of fact, we have one anesthesiologist who's a very good friend of mine who he started his own ASC. So definitely huge anesthesia involvement with that. And I also feel that one plus to having anesthesia as a part owner as well is that when there's problems, they can't just turn a blind eye and walk out the door. You know what? They have to be responsible as an owner and for the overall health. And I know that anesthesia providers aren't always as really good at that. They're not, because a lot of times they're in and out. But I see a huge benefit in that, because all of a sudden they have to say, okay, anesthesia group, even if it's their own group, you know what? What's going on here? What are you doing? Because it's really hurting the overall health of your center. So I think it would be a great idea. And as long as they're paid outside of that, you're fine.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?